Judiciary Committee for Friday, March 23, 2007. We have a long agenda today because of some bills that were rolled over from yesterday because of having to be on the floor earlier than usual. We're going to take it in the order in which they appear on the agenda, and so I will begin first by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2913. Councilor Calmonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2913 establishes that a judgment of a court of a federally recognized Indian tribe, if filed in circuit court and in compliance with federal law regarding qualified domestic relations orders, is a qualified domestic relations order made pursuant to the domestic relations law of the state of Oregon. The bill applies to judgments, decrees, and orders of tribal courts that have been filed before or after the effective date of this bill, declares an emergency, and takes effect upon passage.
We have Michael Mason signed up on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. Mr. Mason.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the House Judiciary Committee. Thank you for considering this bill, and it does have an emergency clause because there truly is an emergency. Last year, let me back up a little bit. My name is Michael Mason. I live in Portland. I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. This is a tribe that has had a very active tribal court for over a century, and for the first time, the Congress has, in part, ignored that fact, passing the Pension Protection Act of 2006 with a provision that did not acknowledge the importance of tribal courts in divorce proceedings and their role in often necessary division of pensions among the family members involved in a divorce. This is of particular importance for the children of these marriages, and while divorce is not a popular pastime at Warm Springs, it still does occur. The dilemma that the tribe is now in is it has exclusive jurisdiction over divorce proceedings and domestic relations of its members on the reservation. However, under the current federal law, any division of a pension is not valid. It's done by the tribal court because it's not a state court order. So what this law would do, and I defer to the chair as an expert in this area because I am not an expert in pension law at all, I'm an expert in Indian law, what this would do is simply allow the tribal court to file its divorce decrees, its domestic relations orders with a state court and thus make them a valid state court order under ERISA. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I do want to stress just how important this is because, again, the Warm Springs Tribal Court has that exclusive jurisdiction. So we'll be left in a position where no one can divide the pension, which is often not a fair result, especially for the children involved.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. And committee members, you'll see that my name is on this bill, although it was brought forward by the tribes, and I did that because in my day job, I work with pensions, and I'm quite familiar with the subject matter, which is that you can't split a pension or other retirement fund or account without getting a state domestic relations order. And so what this bill is doing is it is giving an order that is entered by a tribal court the status of being a state domestic relations order so that then it can be provided to a plan administrator of a plan who will then be obligated to recognize it as though it were entered in a regular Oregon state court. Are there any questions for either Mr. Mason or for me based on that explanation? Okay. Mr. Mason, I might point out that in a conversation with staff, one downside of having this relate to subject matter that I work with ordinarily is I found that there's a reference to qualified domestic relations order, which is probably not quite right in the bill as drafted by legislative counsel. That is, it is a decision of the plan administrator whether an order is a qualified domestic relations order, so that the bill, I think, will read more accurately if it's if it simply gives it the status of being a domestic relations order, which is a defined term in the tax code. So I think there is an amendment that needs to be made to the bill before we move it. But it would be our intention to get that amendment made promptly and bring it back for a work session to do that. Okay. Are there any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Mason. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2913 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 83.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 83 modifies terminology for persons with disabilities in Oregon law. It changes the phrase disabled persons to persons with a disability in several statutes.
I don't see a sign up here. Has anybody signed up on that?
I believe there are no one signed up.
Okay.
You have one question.
Senate Bill 83. So we are in public hearing on Senate Bill 83, and do we have somebody who would like to testify on that?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Okay, please.
One thing I should add, there are amendments to this bill, the dash ones, which are designed to resolve conflicts that have just arisen since it's been passed out of the Senate.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee,
my
name is Judy Cuneo. This is my co-worker Carol Simons. I'm the self-advocacy coordinator for the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. First of all, I would like to thank everyone who worked so tirelessly on this bill. There was a lot of hours put into it. The respectful language bill, Senate Bill 83. It means so much to people with disabilities.
Because I'm who I am because I have cerebral palsy.
I'm not who I am because I have cerebral palsy.
I'm Judy.
I'm Judy. It means so much to people with disabilities. I have been involved in advocacy for the last 30 years. And in the last 10 years, I've been involved full time. This bill will make it so that people will be known for who they are, not their disabilities. Words do have an impact.
A bit.
and some words that are used about people with disabilities are very harmful. All we are asking for is to be known for who we are. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cuneo, and we really appreciate your coming forward and for your long advocacy on behalf of Oregonians with disabilities. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Ms. Cuneo. And yeah, I think that's the only witness we have here coming forward, unless we have unless we need to hear from Mr. DeLashman.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon, provide residential care for people with DD disabilities. We strongly support this bill. I just wanted to put it on the record.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. DeLashman. And we have an amendment to resolve conflicts here in Dash 1s before the committee. And I know that we have Dave Hendricks from Legislative Council here, or is it? I'm sorry. Ah, very good.
Cindy Hunt, Legislative Council's office. Actually, I also have a couple of handouts for the committee on this bill. The handouts that I have for the committee, the bill actually started last session with House Bill 3047. The legislature actually directed our office to begin the process of going through the entire statutes and changing the terminology to words that put the people first before the disability. And so what I've handed out to you is the language of that bill from last session. It directed our office to start the process. Well, we started and ended the process, so to speak. A couple of our copy editors and staff attorneys spent months going through the statutes and combing them with electronic research tools and examining the statutes to find all the instances to change. In some cases, these statutes hadn't been amended in 50 years. And so that's why the bill is so thick. Then also, the other document that I have the committee assistant handing out is our Legislative Council guidelines in this area. These are the guidelines that our attorneys and copy editors follow as they're drafting legislation, including new legislation this session. And you can see on there where, for example, we now use person with a disability as opposed to disabled person. Persons who are blind, not the blind, for example. So throughout the statutes, unless federal law required a certain term, or it was a formal name, like, for example, the School for the Blind, we didn't change the name of the School for the Blind, for example. We went through and changed all the statutes. Unless there's questions?
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Hunt. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Cindy, if you could tell us, please, the significance of the Dash 1 amendments, and it talks about if Senate Bill 269 becomes law, Section 21 of this bill is repealed.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, the Dash 1 amendments is a conflicts amendment, and I would imagine this session you haven't seen very many of these yet. You'll see a lot more as the session progresses.
Oh, I think we've seen some.
Okay. what happened was that Senate Bill 269 is an enrolled bill and is ahead of the process from Senate Bill 83. So when Senate Bill 83 entered this committee that's in the second house, your staff called our staff to get a conflicts check. And they ran a search to see which statutes this bill amended that bills that had already gone through the process also amended. And they came up with Senate Bill 269. What that bill does is it takes and amends 107-500 to take out most of that statute. And that statute contains some forms and things. Well, the part that it took out is actually the piece that this bill is amending. So the amendment that's in Senate Bill 83 is no longer needed because the language isn't in there under Senate Bill 269.
Any further questions for Ms. Hunt? Thank you, Ms. Hunt. Is there anyone else here who wanted to appear on Senate Bill 83? Then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 83 and open a work session on Senate Bill 83. Was there sufficient explanation of the need for the amendment to resolve conflicts?
Mr. Chair, I move, if you're ready for a motion,
I move
dash ones into Senate Bill 83.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 83. Any discussion? Any objection? The dash one amendments are in. And a motion on the main bill.
I have a comment. Okay. We're in discussion. We need a motion first.
No, we could go ahead and
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Cuno, again, Judy, I appreciate all her work and all the legislative council. I think this is very important. And I think it's also a reminder to this body, this committee, that words are important. And we should all look at every bill we have and how those words are expressed, even bills that we've passed. Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just comment, I really liked the statement that this puts people first and addresses people before their definitions.
Yeah. I think that's the spirit behind this bill, I think, is quite uplifting.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 83-1 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 83 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
As amended.
Yeah, as amended. Senate Bill 83 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Excused. Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnick?
Aye.
Chairman
Person. Senate Bill 83 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I guess maybe raise a question here with the committee. This is a conforming step, but I think the spirit behind this bill is such that even though it was a policy choice made in our last session, I think it would be good to have this carried on the floor so that policy choice can be explained. Representative Flores, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd be honored. Thank you.
Thank you. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 83 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 84. Mr. Cummins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 84 corrects grammar and punctuation errors in Oregon law. It deletes obsolete references. And there's also a dash one for this bill as well, which is also intended to resolve conflicts.
And we have no sign-up for this, although from Legislative Council, we probably ought to hear about the background and the nature of the amendments.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Legislative Council's office. Senate Bill 84 is commonly referred to as the Revisers Bill. The last time we did a complete revision of our codification of the statutes was 1953. Before that time, every 10 or 20 years, the legislature found it necessary to go back and recodify and do a complete revision of the statutes because of the mechanisms they used up until 1953. After 1953, when they decided to go to a more professional approach to drafting statutes by establishing Legislative Council's office, they also decided to try to avoid the need to constantly have to go back and do complete revisions. And you may notice in Section 1 of this bill that the policy established by the Legislative Assembly is that they periodically revise the statutes to maintain accuracy. And this bill is one piece of the process that we use to do that. I look at it as a four-level process that we use. The first one is simply our editorial authority. We have very narrow editorial authority to change things in the statutes. That means within our office, without going back to the legislature. For instance, all the bills that you pass that have new sections will have references to sections 3 of this act. At the end of the session, when we go to put those into the Oregon Revised Statutes, we'll assign an ORS number to that section, and we will substitute that number for Section 3, and then we will make sure that all other references to Section 3 are also to the number we've given to that particular section. That's pursuant to our editorial authority, which is laid out in the preface of the ORS about the extent of what we can and can't do. Beyond that, we have problems such as what we see in Senate Bill 84, the second level of our process, and that is things that we have identified as we're drafting bills, or usually during the interim when we're working on various projects and reviewing the statutes, where we spot problems, you know, things like missing words or other things that to us do not look to be substantive in nature, but that need to be fixed. And we find quite a few of them, as you can tell from this, usually in older statutes. Most of the statutes that are in here are not things that happened last session. They are things that happened many, many, many sessions ago. And many of them are just simply bringing old statutes up to more current terminology and current form and style rules used by the office. However, these are not things that we could do pursuant to our editorial authority, so we put together a reviser bill, and we try to make it helpful to the members by doing something that you don't see in any other bill, which is we add a little note at the end of each section that tells you specifically what we're doing in that section and why we're doing it. And that is unique, I believe. I don't know of any other bill that we draft in which we actually give a little note that tells the members what exactly we're doing. We try to get it out early in the session so that any interest group whose statutes might be affected have a chance to look at it and make sure we haven't done something substantive by accident. And at this point, we've had no indication from anybody that any of these sections create a problem for them. And I'll just mention briefly the other two levels of what I think is the process. There are other things that we see as problems in the statutes, and we find that are far more substantive, that aren't substantive, that are just, we don't know what was intended, or we just would not feel comfortable doing it in a bill like the revisers bill. We keep records of those. We have a big set of binders with notes on the statutes, and sometimes when you come to us with an amendment to a section, you might get a call back from our office saying, you know, we have a real problem that exists in the statute. Would you like to put an amendment in it to try to address it? And sometimes the members want to. Sometimes the members will say, well, that's really not my problem. And so sometimes we get them fixed and sometimes we don't. Over time, we tend to get them fixed, but sometimes it's that process. Sometimes it's because we go to the fourth stretch, and that is when we do complete revisions of chapters. And we frequently do that under the auspices of a group like the Oregon Law Commission, where people recognize an entire chapter, for instance, has got so many problems built up over the years that it's just time to rewrite it. And that's really good, because if we do that every now and then, if we fix whole chapters, we avoid the need in the longer run to go back and try to do a complete revision of the statutes, which is a huge, time-consuming and difficult project with lots and lots of issues that come up when you try to go back through and completely rewrite the entire code, which is not something that anybody's voluntarily going to want to engage in. And we've pretty much avoided the need for that over the years by using this process. So I'll just shut up now, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir, and your staff and your colleagues for doing this great work. What was the source? I'm always with my assistant ask, what style book do you use, or what authority do you use for grammar and punctuation?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett. We have a manual that we have developed starting from way, way back, way before my time in the office, and it's a very extensive manual that lays out all of our rules that we use both for grammar and for other more substantive issues as well. It's actually on the Internet. You can go and take a look at it. What it is basically is a much extended version of the form and style manual that's adopted by both chambers as part of their rules at the beginning of each session. We prepare that as well. And the form and style manual that is adopted by the bodies in there are fairly
straightforward, simple things that say, look, you, as a body, we don't even want to change these basic rules. And there's some grammar rules in there, there's some of those other issues, but ours is much more expansive and lays out all of those things that over the years we've made decisions, here's how we're going to do these things.
Quick follow-up.
You may?
Okay. I noticed on the amendments, I couldn't carry the bill, it was so heavy, trying to save my back. But if you look on the amendment on line 11, after the series of lists there, you do not put a comma after disabilities, but on the next page with a semicolon, or a series of things, you did use a semicolon before the conjunctive word.
Yeah, we usually try to avoid. I don't have the amendments right in front of me, so I'm at a disadvantage.
But the question is, do you put a comma after the one before the conjunctive word?
In a series of words, we almost never do, although that is one where on occasion it's actually clearer to put the comma in. That's not one of the hard rules.
Well,
the general rule we follow, though, is if we have a list of three things, A, B, and C, we'll do A, comma, B, no comma, and C. That's
Thank
the
you.
General
Mr.
rule.
Mr. Chair, I think they're looking for English teachers in the school district representative.
But things are clearly getting out of control here.
Chair.
Representative Kump.
I would contend that that's what Representative Wisniew is saying is important, because some of us that don't always speak correct grammar, we certainly notice it in the print. And because American, all language usage changes, but it's many times the commas are lost when they should be put in there, so that you know that it's a distinct idea. But yeah, when we're talking about language, it's pretty important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't resist the opportunity. Strunk and White recommends a serial comma, but common journalistic style does, or
exactly.
Modern journalistic style does not. And as somebody with a bit of editing experience who had to at one point master the difference between that and which, we used to call it witch hunting. So I guess that because they've gone through and changed many of the witches
to that
we're sanctioning witch hunting in Judiciary Committee today.
So we can let the comma and the semicolon.
We talk about organic chemistry.
Chair, but first, and I would just add that we are very sensitive to the significance of commas. They are, you know, they're a very small thing, but many, many cases have hinged on them over the years. And indeed, the courts, the Oregon courts call a rule of construction of statutes called the rule of the last antecedent. Mm-hmm. And it has to do where you have a modifying clause and about which particular noun up the line did that modifying clause. And a comma can very well make the difference on their determination as to what the statute means based on whether it's there or not.
Yeah.
So we are we are hypersensitive to this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And very quickly, thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Although I would, in regard to your fourth element that you had referenced in regard to projects that might be undertaken by the Oregon Law Commission, renew my call that we have them look at the Oregon revised statute, which you don't want to undertake, and for every law that we pass, remove two. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
You were worrying about commas. And how can he spell his name the way he did?
Representative McPherson, Representative Krieger, it makes a great typing exercise.
Yes, right. Senator Corcoran, when I was working with him a couple of sessions ago on a project with Mr. Hendricks, referred to him as vowel impaired. any further questions for Mr. Hendricks? Thank you very much, and thank you for your work. The only way we can express our ideas are in words, and we trust to the good work of Legislative Council to get those words right. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 84 and open a work session on Senate Bill 84.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash ones into Senate Bill 84.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 84. These are amendments to resolve conflicts. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The dash one amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 84 as amended to the floor to do pass.
And would you consider a consent calendar designation for that? Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 84 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement of the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll. Senate Bill 84 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement of the consent calendar. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 84 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2852. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2852. We're going to take this in a little different order. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3163.
Thank you, Chairman Pearson and members of the committee. House Bill 3163 relates to municipal court jurisdiction. Present ORS 221.336 allows any city in Oregon to establish a municipal court by charter ordinance. ORS 221.339 gives municipal courts concurrent jurisdiction with circuit courts over misdemeanors and certain violations. A municipal court has no jurisdiction over felonies. House Bill 3163 amends ORS 221.339 by requiring that a municipal court become a, quote, court of record, close quote, before it can exercise jurisdiction over Dewey's driving under the influence of intoxicants, which that charge is typically a misdemeanor. This procedure is covered under 221.342, that is the procedure to become a court of record. Essentially, there are two requirements. First of all, have a court reporter or audio recording service available for the courtroom. And secondly, ensure that the judge is a member of the Oregon State Bar.
Okay, we have Josh Marquis of the Oregon District Attorneys Association signed up. Mr. Marquis.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Joshua Marquis. I'm the district attorney of Clatsop County, and I can't say that I'm here on behalf of the ODAA. Our organization has mixed feelings about this, and I'll try to tell you. You're going to hear, I think, some from the municipal judges. The reason for this statute is that until maybe 4 or 5 years ago, the fact that muni courts, which were not courts of record and did DUIIs, had judgments that were less than clear was maybe a bit of an irritant. But since the legislature has frankly taken DUII seriously in the last 10 years, you've made the fourth DUII a felony, and on a third DUII, there's a lifetime suspension. So now those predicate DUIIs become very important. And I've personally tried over 300 DUII trials in four different counties. And when I ran this bill past the working deputy DAs that do DUIIs, there was universal support for this. The problem is this. Municipal courts, because they're not courts of record, are not required to keep any particular kinds of records. There is no record of the recording. And if you're going to rely on a DUII conviction to seek to put somebody in prison for their fourth DUII or to ask a judge to permanently revoke their driver's license, you have to be able to prove that the underlying DUII conviction was valid. Now, the value of the muni courts is on DUIIs ranges from awful to excellent. There are already at least several muni courts that have become courts of record, as small as St. Helens and as large as Lake Oswego. There is an amendment in this bill, a proposed amendment, that would limit it to cities' jurisdictions under 25,000. And I'll be very frank with you. The reason for that is essentially monetary or political, and that is that cities like Salem, Eugene, and Springfield, which have large and fairly well-done municipal courts, if they were to cease doing Dewey's and they were to dump them onto the prosecutors of Marion and Lane County with the funding conditions of those offices, it would be very difficult for them to take them on. And I think all prosecutors see DUIIs, albeit they may be misdemeanors on the first ones, as very important cases. The problem is that time and time again, municipal court convictions are often uncounseled. They're simply written on the back of the citation, guilty, and defense attorneys are often very successful in getting circuit court judges not to take them very seriously. if this was 15 years ago and I was asking you to put in stenographic reporting or electronic recording, that would be probably quite onerous. But technology has come a long, long way. We're talking about probably $1,000 in terms of the technology to make a court of record. And as I say, courts as small as St. Helens have done it and larger ones of Lake Oswego. There is also the accountability factor. Municipal court judges are not accountable to anyone except the city councils. They're elected in a couple jurisdictions, which happen to be jurisdictions that would not be covered by this. But for the most part, they are simply employees of the city. They are not subject to the canons of judicial conduct. It's something most people don't know. And as your counsel told you at the moment, there's no requirement that the municipal court judge be a lawyer. I think most communities say they want to have municipal courts because it provides local control and smaller offenses can be handled on a local level. And I think that's fine. And when you're talking about traffic citations, careless driving, even, all of that works. But with the importance of DUII now in our, not just the importance that it carries, but the importance that it has in our criminal code, it is imperative that we be able to rely on the integrity of the DUII convictions. And simply bringing municipal courts into the 20th or 21st century by saying, let's have rules and let's record it so we know when a tree falls in the forest. I'll tell you that city attorneys and I think the municipal judges are concerned about this. I think they're concerned about the cost. I can't tell you that every DA in the state, I know that Jason Carlisle, who is a colleague and friend of mine in Linn County, has some concerns, but their concerns are not on the policy grounds. Their concerns are simply that if those smaller jurisdictions chose to shut down their DUII courts, that they wouldn't be able to handle the DUIIs that came to them. I think that's highly regrettable because I think I know I, as an elected DA, and I know all my colleagues, consider DUIIs high priority. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Linda? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Marquis. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly. If this bill passes, then a municipal court will no longer be able to hear DUII cases unless they become a court of record, which will involve some expense. So what will happen with the DUII cases?
They would go to the circuit court, where they go in, for example, Portland and Bend stops using mini courts for DUIs a long time ago. Frankly, that's where the intention is to go before circuit court judges and district attorney's offices and public defenders so that those cases can be treated in as uniform and as fair a way as possible.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many jurisdictions still hear DUII cases in municipal courts?
Dozens.
Thank you.
Mr. Marquis, I'm trying to understand the significance of the blank that under the Dash 1 amendments would become 25,000. So if I'm reading this correctly, what that means is that smaller cities would have no choice. If they're going to continue handling DUIIs, they would have to become have their municipal court become a court of record. But a larger city could still run a municipal court without being a court of record.
Correct.
And the concern is simply that the volume of activity would be that if they chose not to become a court of record, then the volume of that activity falling on the circuit court would be too burdensome. Is that the rationale?
Two reasons. One is that the larger courts also tend to be the best, larger municipal courts tend to be the best run municipal courts. But frankly, the larger concern is exactly what you stated, that if those larger jurisdictions chose, if they were included, if there was not this break line, that they would then, those cases would fall to the circuit court and the district attorney. And in Salem, for example, I'm told that would be 640 DUIIs a year, which would come to the circuit court and then the Marion County DA's office, which would be very tough.
Let's see. Representative Krieger,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Marquis, in that second section, assured that the judge is a member of the Oregon State Bar. Presently, these municipal courts, how many of those are being conducted by people who are not members of the bar, and what would they do with those jurisdictions that are required to change whose judge is not a member of the bar?
Representative Krieger, Carl Myers is here to argue against this bill from the municipal court judges, and he could probably answer that question better than yours. My When I started practicing, most municipal court judges weren't lawyers. My impression is that over the years that probably about half of them are. And as a practical matter, what this would require is that if they wanted to do DUIIs, I would point out that DUIIs are fairly expensive to operate because, unlike traffic infractions, if you're going to try a DUII as a muni court, you have to hire an indigent defender, you have to hire a city prosecutor, you have to pay for jurors, and if you put people in jail, you have to pay for the jail beds. So it's really apart from the usual kind of thing that muni courts do and do very well.
Any other questions, Ms. McKay?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McPhee. We took this bill out of order because of Mr. McPhee's schedule. So what I'm going to do is close the hearing on House Bill 3163 and go back to where we were on the agenda here to House Bill 2852.
Just for clarification, people that are here to testify on
this. We will reopen it.
Reopen, thank
yes.
you.
Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2852 relates to the authority of Port of Portland peace officers. 1891, the Oregon legislature created the Port of Portland to dredge a shipping channel from Portland to the Pacific Ocean. Today, the port owns several marine terminals, four airports, Portland International, Hillsboro, Merlino, and Troutdale, and seven business parks. Its mission is to enhance the region's economy and quality of life by providing efficient cargo and air passenger access to national and global markets. ORS 778.260 sub 2 provides the port with the authority to appoint peace officers to enforce port, city, and county ordinances and state laws, quote, at airports owned, operated, maintained, or controlled by the port, close quote. House Bill 2852 expands the authority of port officers by specifically including them within the following definitions. The definition of peace officer in ORS 133.005 and in ORS 161.015. The definition of enforcement officer in ORS 153.005 and in the definition of police officer in ORS 801.395. In short, this means that port officers are treated as, I guess you'd say, regular officers with the authority to make arrests, issue citations for crimes or violations. It would allow, if they are attacked, the charges of resisting arrest to be brought against the person who would have attacked the port officers, etc. House Bill 2852 also eliminates the geographical limitation to port officer authority by striking the language, quote, at airports owned, operated, maintained, or controlled by the port.
Okay, we have Annette Price and Chief Phil Klon from the Port of Portland.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Annette Price, and I am the State Affairs Manager with the Port of Portland. I want to thank you for hearing House Bill 2852 this morning and express my gratitude to Representative Barker for his leadership in sponsoring this legislation. You have before you Dash 1 amendments, which will Chief Klon, the Port of Portland Police Chief, will discuss in his testimony. And with that, Chief Klon.
Good morning, Chair McPherson. Members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be heard on this issue. My name is Phil Klein. I'm the Chief of Police with the Port of Portland Police Department. I've been the Chief for just over 4 years. And I will talk about the House bill. Legislative Council did a very good job talking about the bill. I will spend most of my time talking about the amendments and the significance. The amendments make this bill a port security bill, a port security and public safety issue. Before I get into that, let me talk a little bit about the Port of Portland Police Department. We have 53 sworn officers. That includes four detectives, four explosive canine teams. We have Mike Esther, who's one of our handlers, who will speak, so I'll let him speak about the canines and how they are a unique asset to Oregon. We are involved in policing all the usual things that police do. We patrol, we do foot patrol, we do bike patrol, vehicle patrol. We investigate crimes. We make arrests. We issue traffic citations. In 2006, we generated 2,112 police reports, and we made 733 arrests. What is unique to the Port of Portland Police is that we also provide for the airport security. There are federal regulations that require police at the airport to perform certain functions. We are the ones, the first responders, who respond to suspicious activity or concerns about airport security. We also investigate. We recently issued a commemorative badge. I'm proudly displaying it here, celebrating our 50th year as a police agency. And you'll notice in the middle here, there's kind of a miniature version of the badge that was worn by the first port officers in the 1950s. In the 1950s and 60s, those officers not only provided police services, but they did some other things, such as monitoring aircraft traffic on the airfield, and also looking for foreign object debris on the airfield. In the 70s, there were some drastic changes because hijacking became a national concern, and there were some sweeping federal regulations that caused the Port Police to actually double in size. We had officers at every checkpoint, although we also had officers in vehicles providing some outside patrol as well. I'd like to fast forward now to where we are right now. As you all know, transportation security is not all about aviation anymore. And in matter of fact, even before 9/11, USS Cole was the victim of a Marine-based terrorist act. We all know 9/11 was an aviation terrorist attack. The Madrid bombings were a rail transit attack. The London bombings were a rail and bus transit terrorism attack. Aviation security is no longer the only game in town. In response to 9/11, Our department grew by about 30%. And as we've gone on through the years, not only has aviation security changed, but marine security has changed. Congress has come out not only with aviation security regulations, but also on the marine side. And I don't think Congress is done yet. As we sit here, I think they're probably still working on transportation security. Our marine facilities, very similar to the airport, have their own set of federal regulations. And like the TSA regulates the airport, the U.S. Coast Guard regulates the marine terminals. Internally, the port has also had to make some adjustments. Before 9/11, they had a police department. They really didn't have a security department. The police department pretty much took care of that. After 9/11, because of the increasing demands, the port has developed to the point where it has a standalone security manager who is a corporate officer, and under that manager is police, fire, aviation security, marine security, the communication center, and emergency management for the Port of Portland. In the past 2 years, the Port Police have provided support to the marine facilities on operations. Our canines have done sweeps out there. We've done training. We have done investigations. We have provided intel and information sharing as well. All of this is lining up with Executive Bill Wyatt's One Port concept, which is break down the silos and consider the port as a whole. We need to communicate. We need to cooperate. The port needs to look at security in all its aspects. We're not alone in trying to secure these facilities. We have ongoing, very good working relationships with Multnomah County. You have a letter from County Sheriff Bernie Giusto in favor of this bill, including the amendments. We have a very close relationship with the Portland Police Bureau. You have a letter from Chief Rosie Sizer in support of this bill. We also work very regularly with other Oregon law enforcement and with federal law enforcement, all with the same goal, to keep the port facilities safe. I think it's very significant to point out I have also, on an ongoing basis, have a project with Chief Rosie Sizer from the Police Bureau to develop a mutual aid agreement so that our roles are spelled out in terms of how we interact as an agency. That is in the advanced draft stages, and I will say that the language in that IGA lines up very well with the language in this bill, including the amendments. The 2852 was very accurately described by counsel, and I want to thank Representative Barker for including that on his agenda and bringing this forward this session. But in looking at this legislation, doing my own preparation for this session, I realized I missed something that's a really big picture issue. And that is 778.260 is specifically aimed and focused on airports. That is an antiquated concept in 2000, in this era. In doing some research, I contacted a lot of other port authorities. I went up to the Port of Seattle and did site visits. I spent several hours with one of their sergeants, having them take me around to their marine facilities and talk about what they do. They have fairly extensive marine operations up there. The Port of Seattle Police is about twice the size of my department. They have most of their officers on a daily basis are assigned to the airports. However, they do have two officers generally assigned to the marine facilities as well. I will also say that under Washington law, the Port of Seattle is specifically enabled to appoint peace officers to police port properties. And as I did my research, that seemed to be fairly consistent with other standalone port authorities like the Port of Portland. So the significance of the amendments. Very simple solution. Replace all the references to airports with the word properties. Give the Port of Portland the ability to assign their peace officers to protect all of their properties. It's a very simple amendment, but it's a very significant amendment. Council provided the mission of the Port of Portland. It's a very broad-based mission. My belief is that the mission of the Port Police should align with the mission of the Port of Portland. The Port of Portland should be able to use all of its resources to protect any and all of its facilities, operations, or assets. The final thing I'd like to add is that some of you, maybe all of you, have been contacted by individuals in opposition to this bill. And those individuals are focused on a specific airport ordinance, which they feel affects their ability to their rights as concealed handgun permit holders. Their issue is with a specific airport ordinance. This bill really doesn't have anything to do with the airports. In fact, it has to do with the rest of the Port of Portland. That is not addressed in 778.260. It's not about airports. It's about the port as a government agency, just like any other government agency, with the responsibility to secure all their operations in a dynamic and different security and threat environment. It's about the port, which is a standalone port authority, having the same statutory authority as just about any other standalone port authority in the nation. And once again, it's not about the airport. It's about ensuring the port can use all of its resources to protect any and all of its facilities and assets and operations. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Klein. And I, or should I say, Chief? Apologize.
It's quite all right.
I would like some clarification for the record, please. The definition of peace officer is contained in ORS 133.005, which this is amending, relates to arrest and related procedure. 161.015 relates to crimes and punishment.
Yes.
ORS 153.005 relates to violation and traffic offense.
Correct.
Now, I understand the purpose of the bill is to keep the port facilities safe and to police port properties.
Yes.
Including the definition of the port officers in the peace officer definition. How do we determine by this bill that that is limited to port facilities and port properties and not streets in other areas, streets in areas?
It's not. In fact, we've operated under the premise that we have full police authority just like any other peace officer or sheriff or police officer. Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, allow me to give you a short history, because this has been an issue that crops up on occasion. And in fact, I went back and got the legislative testimony from 1979, which is the last time 778.260 was visited. And they're talking about the authority of Port Police. And what they're trying to do in 79 is ensure that we have the same authority as other peace officers. Unfortunately, the way the law is written, especially Section 2, it appears that it says we have the authority, but then there's a clause right after that which seems to limit it geographically. My read of the 1979 legislature was their intent was that we would have full authority as police officers, and the clause about airports was a jurisdictional statement. And there's two different concepts here. There's police authority and there's police jurisdiction. Police officers in Oregon have statewide authority. Our jurisdiction is the Port of Portland, and currently right now it's the airports of the Port of Portland. So we're really looking at the amendments are really talking about jurisdiction. It also helps because what happens is attorneys will read 778.260 Section 2, and they'll read that clause at airports owned and operated, and because they don't know what the legislative intent was, they take a plain read of it, and they read it as if the second part of the sentence restricts our authority. So we'd like to get rid of that. The inclusion in the other definitions is mostly a housekeeping issue. As I said, this has come up on several occasions, and there have been a lot of different attempts to fix it. The last fix, and the one that we're currently operating under, is a 1993 city ordinance. The city of Portland passed an ordinance basically deputizing us as adjunct city of Portland police officers. And that is the legal premise by which we are basing our authority, that we are deputized by the city of Portland, therefore we have the same authority, because of the problems with the language. So, yes, this is a port bill. There are some housekeeping issues also that we're trying to fix to eliminate this whole argument about our authority, because we've always operated and pretty much under, I think it's an understanding that we have the same authority as any other law enforcement in Oregon, which is statewide authority.
Mr. Bonilla.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Then let me ask it another way for clarification. you have the same authority as other police peacekeepers,
mm-hmm.
peace officers, in the same jurisdictions that they do? In other words, you could give me a ticket in downtown Portland.
Chair McPherson and Representative Flores, that is technically correct for any peace officer, any certified officer in the state of Oregon. As a practical matter, we don't do that.
I'm trying to get clarification in case I run across you in downtown.
Well, but it is the same for any peace officer in Oregon. If they have the ability to to use their police authority anywhere in the state. It, technically, if someone from Multnomah County was in Clackamas County and observed a traffic violation, they could issue a citation. And our authority is the same.
Follow up. Technically, that may be true, but do they not use other peace officers act within their own jurisdictions rather than ticket outside their area of patrol?
Yes, and actually, most agencies have specific policies about if you take action in the jurisdiction of another agency. For us, since we fall within the city of Portland, I think it's very important that we have a mutual aid agreement that spells out how that happens, because we're always operating. We actually have a concurrent jurisdiction with the city of Portland, which is why I'm going forward with seeking an agreement, a mutual aid agreement with them.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up comment, and that is I'm just trying to get this clarification, because I know there is extreme concern about broadening the jurisdictional authority for the Port of Portland peace officers.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Bottomici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Klun, do the Port of Portland peace officers receive training that's at least equal to that of other police officers?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bottomici. Yes, absolutely. We go through the police academy. We are certified by the state of Oregon. We recently got a letter from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training letting us know that we are in complete compliance with their recertification. Each officer has to have a certain amount of hours in a three-year period, and every one of our officers meet that.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Chief, Bings, you brought up the ordinance on the right to carry, and thank you for coming by yesterday and having a conversation with me about it. Last session, we had a summer bill that didn't move because of that issue, and there was no giving. I was the chair. There was no giving on this issue, and so that bill did not move. Mm-hmm. And I explained to you yesterday I didn't want every jurisdiction of the city, county, violating Oregon's existing preemption law on the right to carry. We had a good conversation, a very respectful and understanding. But I do think that you need to be bringing your board to the table, make them understand the importance of that. The second part of that is, since that time, we have had a federal right to carry where myself, as retired police officer, Representative Barker, your people, when you get that, you can carry anywhere in the United States, and one of the places, as I understand, that is not exempt is airports. So what I'm asking you is, we have a federal law that says I can carry on your property. How are you going to handle that? And I talked to you yesterday. We can find out. I'll come, and I'll let you know I'm coming. How are you going to handle that?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, thanks for the question. The federal carry law that applies to retired police officers has certain standards that those retired officers have to meet. Under my read of the port ordinance that you're referring to, there's actually several existing exemptions, and one of those exemptions is law enforcement, armed law enforcement. And I think that extends to retired law enforcement as well.
Go ahead.
Just to follow up, so you're going to allow one group of Oregonians who have a concealed permit, whether it be state or federal, to do it because we're retired police officers, but you're not to extend that same, obviously, both legislative, federal, and state intent to the general public who has met the exact same standards of background checks to qualify them as a right to carry. The difference is that one time you were a police officer.
Representative Krieger, actually what I'm saying is what I'm repeating to you is what the ordinance says. There, the ordinance does provide for some exceptions, and law enforcement is one of the exceptions that's provided for. concealed handgun permit holders are not included in those exceptions as that ordinance is read.
Any further questions for Chief Kahlon? Then I have just one question, which is that do these changes have any impact on other matters like labor relations? I'm thinking about whether these officers are strike barred, whether they're public safety for PERS coverage, that sort of thing.
Chair McPherson, those have already been established. We are police and fire PERS. They are strike barred. I will defer to Mr. Esther. He is actually our union president. He's not only a canine handler, but he's our union president. We've actually talked about this beforehand. We don't anticipate any union issues at this time. And there certainly isn't going to be any change in status. We've already been extended full PERS benefits as police officers under the police and fire PERS, and we do fall under the public safety exceptions in regards to collective bargaining.
Very good. Thank you, Chief Kahlon.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to add, and I've spoke to the chief about these issues before, but in my many years with Portland City Police, I've worked numerous times in and out, and I know some of the officers there, and I just want to, for Representative Forrest especially, put your mind at ease that that is a very professional and good department compared to some others around the state.
Thank you.
I appreciate that assurance, except for the last statement.
thank you, Chief Kahlon, Ms. Price. I'd like to have the panel come forward now, Mary Botkin, Mike Esther, and Jeff Galloway.
You forgot one name.
Oh, yeah, and Linda. Linda.
We'd feel better if she'd lay down.
Look at my knees.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am not going to take a lot of the committee's time. You see me almost every day, or every day in the building at least. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We're here in support of 2852 as it is written. And with me today is Jeff Galloway and Mike Esther and Linda. And they will, I think the chief has sort of outlined what the bill does along with council. We don't need to go through all that. I have written testimony I will give to the committee stating our support for the bill. And I will just step here to help answer any questions you may have that the officers are unable to answer. And with that, I'd just like them to talk a little bit about what they do and their job and how it's changed over the years. Thank you.
Very good. In whichever order you prefer, gentlemen.
Sorry, excuse me. Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Esther, and the rest of the committee. My name is Mike Esther. I'm a canine handler with the Port of Portland. I'm also the president of the police union there, represented by AFSCME Council 1847. I've been a police officer at the airport for 23 years almost, and almost 27 years in total. I'm here speaking on behalf of the union itself and the members of the union. We are in total support of this House bill, what Chief Kahlon just spoke to you about. My role as a canine handler, I'm also a member of the Portland Metropolitan Explosive Disposal Unit, which is comprised of officers from agencies all around the metro area. Our dogs are used on bomb call-outs. We've searched down at the docks when we've gotten threats that require the use of our canines. We train with the City of Portland bomb techs. Our department has a bomb tech currently, and we've traveled, you know, from Southwest Washington throughout the state of Oregon. The Port of Portland has a lot of assets. Members of our department go out to Troutdale when they've had like a plane accident. In the past, we've gone out to Hillsborough to take reports on plane accidents. And I think the port has absolute justification for wanting to protect all their assets. You know, after 9/11, clearly the game has changed, the rules have changed. Or not the rules, but knowing what can be threatened and how, frankly, easy it is to destroy something. Excuse me. So now.
My namesake is a little wily.
You know, protecting the port's assets and allowing the port to protect their assets as defined in this amendment protects all of Oregon, protects all of our assets, because if something should happen out there, it will have an impact. Knock on wood, it doesn't ever happen, but if it did happen, it would impact the entire state and the entire region. And so I'm here today in support of Chief Kwan. I think that what he is doing is the right thing to do, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Officer Esther? Thank you, Officer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Committee, my name is Jeff Galloway. I'm a police officer with the Port of Portland Police Department. I'm here representing AFSCME and supporting the Port of Portland and Chief Kwan on this House bill. I, too, am involved in the union. I'm the union vice president. I'll work along with Mike. I'm basically here just to give you an insight as to what your average day police officer at the Port of Portland goes through, the work we do. I've been there 7.5 years. I've been on patrol that entire time. Consisted of vehicle patrol, foot patrol, bike patrol. I'm also involved in as an instructor in many different areas. As instructing, training has taken place with members of the City of Portland. I was done some instructing training with Beaverton Police Department. And these are all usually affiliated with DPSST. I'm proud to say that I think we have well-trained, intelligent, educated, professional police officers working at the airport. I can assure you that that we take pride in the fact that we do a good job, and we're here to help to serve the public, people, the members of the Port of Portland, as well as the employees and such at the airport. I personally have been involved in many different types of cases. It runs the gamut that you'd hear of in whichever city you come from. We deal with domestic violence issues. We've had drunk drivers pull into the lower road, done pedestrian versus vehicle accidents. And this is just right at the airport terminal. These do take place all around the airport. We have had firearms issues at the airport, in the terminal. Just want to let you know, we do see a lot of aspects that city-type county police officers deal with out there in the airport terminal. And I think it's important that we are there for the folks that work there and for those folks that are coming to visit the state of Oregon. Bringing their business or pleasure to travel. We're often a sounding board for them for when they have been victimized. And I think that I feel good about being able to be there and do that for them. I have worked fairly closely as an up patrol officer with many different jurisdictions. We get calls from folks from Salem, for instance, asking for assistance. I remember specifically Lake Oswego was looking for an assault suspect who happened to be coming to the airport. We were able to assist in finding that subject in the airport terminal. We work with Southwest Washington agencies, just agencies all over the area, including agencies from out of state. We work closely, and I think it's important that that we do that, and we are able to assist everybody. And I don't really know what else to say. I appreciate the time, and I'm more than willing to discuss anything or answer any questions.
Representative Whitman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Either one of the officers, could you please tell me how your job has changed with the expansion and the creation of TSA? Have you lost some responsibilities? Have they gained responsibilities? Are you just double covering those areas? Or what's
Representative, I would say as being on patrol every day I work generally, definitely our response has probably increased. I do know after 9/11 that a lot of the restrictions at the airport were increased. For instance, just an example, the hijackings for 9/11, those items that they actually used were not prohibited. They are now prohibited. You cannot take those, as well as many other items. People are trying to hide these items. We're responding to those calls of intentionally trying to hide things on. We're finding things hidden in the non-secured part of the airport, hoping that they can come back later and get these talking pocket knives. I think there was even a firearm at one time, dismantled, was found in a restroom. So yes, things, they have more security. However, it has increased our call load and increased our duties in working with them. I think we have a good working relationship. It's definitely, we have a federal side, and we're also interested with the state laws. And so it's been a, for patrol, it's been a work in progress. But it has increased our call load simply because I think the restrictions have been increased.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Ms. Bodkin and a question for Officer Galloway. Ms. Bodkin, you indicated in your written testimony as well as your oral statement that you support the bill as written. Now, there is a Dash 1 amendment that expands or provides a definition from airport to port facilities.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, we're fine with that amendment.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
Yeah. We saw that as a technical change, and I'm sorry, I did not pick up on that when I was doing the testimony. All right, it changed my testimony.
And then my follow-up. Thank you. Officer Galloway, as you were speaking to us, and by the way, thank you both for the work that you do, you indicated that you had some encounters in dealing with firearm situations at the port or within the airport. Could you give us a little...
But
flavor for that?
Not so much me in particularly. I mean, I do recall an instance where a firearm was in a bag and it discharged in the belly of an airplane, went up through the bottom of the airplane and lodged in a baby's diaper bag as the flight was boarding. The TSA has requirements to... You can transport the firearms as checked luggage. You just have to follow protocol, which is set of rules to do that properly. In terms of trying to think of anything that I've specifically done with firearms, there has been occasion where they've been in bags going through the security checkpoint. People trying to get them onto aircraft, getting them through the security onto the aircraft. And I travel a lot. That's something that I don't want. And I don't think we should want to have people toting guns on airplanes. I think I'm not an expert on aviation aircraft, but the fact that a bullet can go right through the belly of an airplane, in which we have seen the cases that's happened. I don't know what that can do to an airplane at 35,000 feet, but I do know it's a scary situation if that were to occur. Sorry.
Follow up?
Me?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, Officer Esther, you wanted to say something, too, in that regard.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Flores, actually, that was the case that he was alluding to was a case that I investigated when I was in a detective. prior to becoming a canine handler. And it was a gun that a lady had put in a bag, never declared it. Typically, without going to wasting, or not wasting your time, but taking too much of your time, typically people, they can travel with guns in their suitcases if they're in a locked container. But the issue is that you have to declare the thing before, you know, when you go up to the ticket counter, you have to declare it. That incident happened probably about 5 years ago, I guess. It was probably even longer than that, because I got out of detectives in 2002. So it was probably about year 2000 this happened. Lady never declared her gun. Handlers, you know, she had it in her check bag. Handlers were taking it. It was a loaded weapon. They threw it on the plane as it's going up that little baggage ramp, and it went off. It was a .22 Magnum pistol. The lady was going back to Alaska. She had gotten it from a relative or something. Anyway, it went up, went through the floor, and lodged at the feet of the father with a baby in the diaper bag. And so, look, it goes on at the airport. I mean, what we do, it goes from soup to nuts, frankly. We get 13, 14 million people a year coming through the airport.
So we probably know
we
a lot
see,
of those nuts.
We see everything. So, you know, whatever goes on, like in the city of Salem, we can generally at some point come across it at the Port of Portland. We don't get a lot of homicides, obviously. I have investigated at least one rape back in 97. We've had, suicides, theft cases, car break-ins, domestic violence, burglaries, occasionally a robbery. But the one thing that is kind of funny is that people, I don't think, really expect such a quick response when we get a call. I mean, the cops are crawling out of the woodwork at this point, and all of a sudden they're all over the place. So that's it. I mean, it's just like most any other agency that you would find in the state of Oregon. We have the same problems with like any other police agency when it comes to crime.
Mr. Chair, just one last follow-up.
Okay.
And thank you. I appreciate kind of expanding your areas of responsibility and what you deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I think my query in regard to the firearms issue is not so much as what people are trying to get on airplanes, because there is a safety issue, and if it's loaded, that seems to be a violation of firearm safety in the first place. And I think we heard last year about the trailblazer who, oops, found a gun in his something or other, and how did it get through security, I think, is the question. But do you have problems with firearms coming into, let's say, the airport facility by people who are not proceeding beyond security? I mean, have you dealt with issues in that regard?
Representative Chairman and Ms. Representative Flores, I can't give you a specific, but after 23 years of working out there, I have arrested people who have carried concealed weapons at the airport. At some point in my career, I have done that. We have taken guns off of people parked in the roadways. One case that comes to mind that I was involved in, lady went up to the ticket counter with stolen credit cards, attempted to purchase airline tickets fraudulently, arrested her. Her mom was sitting in the car on the upper road waiting, arrested her, took a gun off of her. So, so it happens. The number of people that have been arrested, I believe, over since 9/11, bringing guns to the checkpoints has probably diminished, but it hasn't gone entirely away. It's been my experience when I was a detective that most of the gun cases like that were women who carried a firearm in their purse for self-protection, and frankly, they forgot about it. And they would, they're traveling, they're going through the airport, they put their purse on there, the x-ray shows the weapon. Oh my God, I forgot about it. I've pulled cigarette butts out of gun barrels in the bottoms of purses. I can tell you that. I mean, people And, you know, I own a lot of guns myself. I believe people have the right to carry and bear arms and protect their protect themselves at all times. But in that particular case, the woman didn't even realize she had it or forgot that she had it. And, you know, it became somewhat problematic because we have it now, you know, type thing. But I guess that's it.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Krieger.
Just briefly, I like some of your answers. I appreciate what you do, of course. And I don't know anyone that wants people having concealed weapons at the airports who don't have a permit to have one concealed or would be in violation if they're out in the street in downtown Portland or on the highways when I stopped them. What, you know, you have a prerogative to verbally warn, cite, especially on ordinances. Now, you got an ordinance there that says can't have a weapon. On an average, how would you deal, Representative Flores, my chair, who maybe don't have concealed weapon permits, or if they've got one, they're in violation of law, period. But if they had a concealed weapon permit and they're in that portion of the airport that not past security, obviously, how would you handle those? Or is it you're aware of the fact that what the state law says, you're aware that your ordinance is in violation of the state law, so are you going to push that to the hilt, or are you going to say, look, we have an ordinance that can't, you can't carry, we'd appreciate that you not bring your weapon in the future here. How are you going to handle it?
Well, I'll tell you something. Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
I've been warned
on the protocol. So.
Doing just fine.
We don't worry about that.
I'm going to
a
gun.
You do this all the time with Mary anyway.
Yeah, I know. Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger. As I said before, you know, I think the total is somewhere around 13 to 14 million people a year come through the Portland airport that travel. And then you throw in, you know, the 2.2 people that go, that come out with everybody that travels. And so, you know, we're up into the 20 million numbers for the people that come through the airport. I think maybe Chief Klon could give you more accurate numbers, but that's a ballpark. Sit down. The problem is that, you know, I imagine that there are a lot of people that come through that airport who have a concealed weapon on them. But if I have to come in contact with those people, not now as a canine handler because I train, I'm ready for bombs and things like that. But if an officer has to come in contact and deal with a problem and they find that the person has a concealed weapons on them, that person must have done something to draw the attention of the cop. You know, maybe drinking, getting loud, getting into an argument with the ticket counter agent, having a beef with their wife, or, you know, something is going to have to draw our attention. We don't go up and start poking around in everybody's business. We respond to calls for service. And although we can go and chit-chat with anybody we want to, just like anybody else, you know, most of the officers are out watching for disorderly conduct things going on and just making sure everything's working smoothly. To kind of answer your question, if I had to respond to a call, let's say Representative Cameron was creating a scene to it that generated a call for service, and the police went down and made contact and found out that he had a concealed weapons permit and he was carrying concealed, I would think that they probably would cite him under the port ordinance just because we got called on something that he was doing. Now, that's my opinion. They might cut him. They might cut him. Cut him a break. Who knows? It's just that know that, you know, coming through a checkpoint, that's a whole different ball of wax. That's the TSA. That's federal.
Absolutely.
And to answer one of the questions that was asked earlier, I think from the vice chairman. The TSA controls those checkpoints. It's not the Port of Portland police. It's not anybody else. They have the authority there. Pre-9/11, I think that practically speaking, we had the authority there. They had hired private screeners at that point. But after 9/11, when the federal government stepped in and they created this enormous agency, they deal with it now. It's federal now. You know, you get beyond the checkpoint and go down to the concourse, it becomes our problem. You come up to the checkpoint, it's our problem, but the checkpoint itself is TSA's issue.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then I'll excuse. Representative Cameron.
Well, I think we're spending a lot of time talking about the gun policy at the airport, and I'm trying to still look in this bill and see what this bill does that talks to that. I don't see anything about that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Cameron. It's a good focus that this bill really doesn't engage that issue directly.
I have one more question. It's to Linda. Who represents Linda, Mary?
I probably represent.
Does she have a good benefit package?
Security department at the airport. And you notice that she came over and I got to pet her again.
Yeah. Thank you for your service.
I love Linda.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions or comments, I'll excuse
Mr. Chair, let me just, for the record, make it very clear.
Yeah.
In the 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph of my testimony, I clearly state that this bill does not make any changes in wages, benefits, or retirement programs.
Yes, thank you very much
for
putting that out.
These officers are already covered by all of the programs that cover the rest of public safety officers in Oregon, so there won't be any changes in their duties day-to-day.
Very good.
Thank
you for coming in.
All right, thank you.
I want to note for the record here, I was passed a note by Brian DeLashment, who wanted to have me note for the record that the Oregon Council of Police Association supports this bill. Then we have two more witnesses signed up, and I'd like to invite them forward together, Kevin Sterrett and Rod Harder. And I might note we're going to have to conclude our meeting promptly at 10:30 because of some other commitments. And so it would be my hope to be able to return to the public hearing for House Bill 3163. So if we could keep this focused on the bill at hand, gentlemen, I realize that you have a broader concern about the policy of firearms at the airport. But really, this bill is about designation as law enforcement officers or peace officers. Go ahead.
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. As you know, this bill was passed out of committee last session and then returned to the floor committee where it died. Regret that I was unable to attend the hearing, but I'm pleased that the bill was subsequently returned. The issue with this bill is simple. Do you, as legislators, make the rules, or do you not? If you do not make the rules and agencies simply ignore them, should those agencies be rewarded with expanded powers? And if you do reward them with expanded powers, what message is sent to others who find some of the rules we live under to be inconvenient or distasteful? I can tell you from long and expensive experience that there are many agencies and departments that, in fact, routinely break the law, and the Port of Portland is one of them. All of you have received or should have received the documents that I just provided to you in electronic format last week. For your convenience, I provided them again. The first page of your handout is Oregon's preemption statute. I believe this statute is not in the least bit ambiguous. It says, except as expressly authorized by state statute, the authority to regulate in any manner whatsoever the sale, acquisition, transfer, ownership, possession, storage, transportation, or use of firearms, or any element relating to firearms and components thereof, including ammunition, is vested solely in the Legislative Assembly. It's not vague. It does not require a law degree to read and understand. Furthermore, it states, ordinances that are contrary to this subsection are void. The second page is Oregon's statute on firearms in public buildings. It states that this is a felony, that it's a felony to have a firearm in a public building. It also clearly exempts license holders. I've highlighted the relevant sections for you. It should be simple and straightforward, but nothing is simple and straightforward when people want to make their own rules. And the Port of Portland wants to do just that. As you probably know, and as has been discussed, the Portland Airport is posted with signs saying that no weapons are allowed, even with a permit. Page 3 of your handout is the actual ordinance that the Port uses to justify this prohibition. For anyone who thinks that this policy may have been a response to the attacks of 9/11, let me point out the ordinance is dated, 1996. In an effort to determine where the port got the authority to override state law, I called the port police and was told by Sergeant Barrett that license holders were barred from the airport, quote, just as they are from schools. This isn't true. License holders are not barred from schools. So I contacted the chief of the Port of Portland Police by email, asking him to clarify where they believed that authority came from. That email is the fourth document in your handout. I did not receive a response from the chief, but I did get a phone call from the port's lawyer. She left a message telling me that a violation of the ordinance had a penalty of $250, but did not explain the contradiction with state law. She did, however, make note that she was giving my name to the Department of Homeland Security so we could discuss my, quote, desire to carry a gun in the airport. I think you'll see that at no point in any of the communications was such a desire expressed or implied. I simply sought a clarification of the law. I made several attempts to contact her, but from that point forward, she would not return my calls. On February 16th of 2004, I sent a letter to the chief. That letter is the fifth document in your handout. Once again, in the courteous fashion for which I am so well known, I requested that the chief clarify why he thought he could arrest people with concealed handgun licenses simply for being in the airport. On the 19th, the chief replied with a brief email that is the sixth document in your handout. As you can see, once again, he provided no answer to my questions, only warning me to advise my, quote, constituents not to carry in the airport. The seventh document in your handout is my email response to the chief, wherein I, one more time, asked the chief to provide the statute that gave the port the authority to write the law. On February 24th, I received a letter from the port's attorney, Barbara Jacobson, explaining why, in excruciating detail, she believed the port could make up its own rules. That is document number eight. On March 15th, Representative Wayne Scott received an opinion from Legislative Council, your attorneys, on this issue. This is the ninth document in your handout. In contrast to Ms. Jacobson's opinion, which I considered tortured at best, LC was refreshingly to the point. As you can see, they said, you ask whether the Port of Portland has the authority to enact regulations prohibiting a person carrying a firearm into the terminal at Portland International Airport.
Mr. Starr, I'm going to break in at this point. We have less than 20 minutes left today, and we have two more bills, and there are people who have traveled a good way to testify them who are going to be testifying squarely on the point that is at issue in the bills. And what I perceive is happening is that you're going into a lot of history on a topic that's a bit of a tangent from the main thrust of this bill, which is that whether we extend the authorities that are associated with being a peace officer to the police officers who work at the Port of Portland. And so I'd really urge you to come to a conclusion here focusing on that question. I think I took your point that you think we shouldn't be expanding the authority of police officers who are not doing one in their performance of their responsibilities, doing one thing that you take issue with. But I think this lengthy history here is a bit of a tangent from the bill that's before us.
Well, so the lengthy history is necessary for people to understand why it's a problem. And as I stated initially and would close with, what this bill does is reward agencies that violate the law and violate the statutes that you very clearly wrote. If the preemption statute does not apply to the Port of Portland, or the City of Portland, or the City of Hillsborough, or to the Portland Schools, or to the Bend Police Department, who does it apply to? And if this bill expands someone's power and rewards them in spite of the fact that they violate your rules and the rights of a class of citizens in this state, I think it's a dangerous mistake and sends a dangerous message to every other agency.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sterrett.
Can I ask a brief question, Mr. Sterrett?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. It'll be brief. Mr. Sterrett, I did read, I got your email, and I did go back and read all this underlying information just because I think it raises a lot of interesting questions. But what I boiled it down to is there's an opinion from the Port of Portland Council. There's a legal opinion from Legislative Council that's contrary. And with all due respect to both councils, we are a legislative branch, not the judicial branch. Has there ever been a judicial interpretation of those issues?
We've had made several attempts to get judicial decisions on these issues. For example, when the City of Portland, we sued the City of Portland.
On this particular issue.
Just this very issue about preemption, yes. And there has not, we sued the Oregon University System, and in no case was there a resolution.
Thank you. That's all I wanted to know. Thank you.
Mr. Harder.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder. I'm the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. I will be very brief. For the record, I think the chief referred to me as an individual, and that's very true, except I represent 63,000 members in the state of Oregon. So, just for the record. Our stand is very much like that of Mr. Starrett's. There's a little history. Last session when this bill was pulled back, I met with Pat Egan, who was then the lobbyist for the Port of Portland, and offered and said that if we get this rule taken care of, this illegal rule taken care of, that we would be happy to support the bill. And I, this morning, have no particular objection to the bill as written. My objection comes, just like Mr. Starrett, in that is it proper for you as legislators to have someone fly in your face with an illegal law and then extend their authority? And that's the end of my testimony, and I would be happy to answer any questions if anyone has them.
Are there any questions for Mr. Harder? Rips on the camera.
Quick question. To either one of you, is there other airport authorities that have similar statutes throughout the United States, and can you just describe those?
Well, sorry, Representative Cameron, every one of those airports would be under the laws of the state. So, for example, recently a person who was traveling through New Jersey who was in totally lawful possession of a handgun that was in his checked luggage was arrested by the Port of New York, New Jersey police and spent about 8 days in jail. He's been released and he's now suing them. They will have rules depending on what their locality is, the jurisdiction in which the airport is. So it would be the state law that would take effect there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, in Oregon, I am not aware of any other airport or entity that hasn't rescinded because of pressure that was put on them some of these inappropriate and illegal ordinances.
As has Department of Administrative Services has just done that, as has the Deschutes County Commissioners.
Mr. Chair, if I may, what's the Eugene Airport do?
I don't know.
I don't know either, Representative Cameron. I have not had a complaint.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, I'll excuse these witnesses then, and that concludes the sign-up for House Bill 2852. And because we're running so short on time, we won't be working the bill today. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2852. We had opened, as you recall, a public hearing on 3163, which I hope to return to. But seeing that we had also noticed a public hearing on 2858 and that one of those witnesses has traveled at some distance to come to testify, then I'm going to go to House Bill 2858, and we will not be getting back to 3163 today. We'll have to continue that hearing another day. So I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2858. Councilor Stanton.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2858 relates to the insanity defense in criminal prosecutions. ORS 161.295 allows a defendant to plead an affirmative defense of guilty except for insanity if the person was unable to appreciate the criminality of conduct or to conform his or her conduct to the law due to mental disease or defect. ORS 161.309 discusses the procedural requirements for a defendant to utilize this defense. Presently, a defendant must give written notice of his intent to use the defense at the time he pleads not guilty, or at a later time if the court consents. A defendant who fails to file such written notice may not introduce evidence to establish an insanity defense, that is, unless the court finds just cause to allow the defendant to do so at some future day. House Bill 2858 amends ORS 161.309 to require a defendant who wishes to assert an insanity defense to submit to the court, prior to trial, an evaluation by a certified psychiatrist or psychologist. Failure to submit such a report precludes the defendant from introducing evidence of insanity at trial, that is, unless the court permits such evidence to be introduced where the defendant shows just cause for the failure to submit the report. In addition, House Bill 2858 eliminates existing ORS 161.237(1)(c), which provides that when a court orders a psychological evaluation of a person who qualifies for public assistance, the court must order the Public Defense Services Director to pay a reasonable fee for the evaluation from appropriate funds. And I should note then for the record that with House Bill 2858, parties involved, including the Oregon Criminal Defense Lobby and then the other proponents, are presently working on potential amendments and a compromise.
Very good. We have John McCulley and Joseph Bloom, M.D.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John McCulley. I'm representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. Want to express appreciation to the committee for introducing this bill on behalf of our association and the Oregon Psychological Association, and to Representative Comp for facilitating drafting of the bill. As counsel said, there are some issues that have arisen since the bill has come out, and we will be working with parties who are concerned about the bill to try to reach resolution, but we thought we would appear before you today just to describe the issue so that you're familiar with that, and then hopefully return at a future date with an agreed-upon bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think you now have some written testimony, and I'll try to do this very quickly. My name is Joseph Bloom. I'm a psychiatrist. I've worked at Oregon Health Sciences University for 30 years. I was dean of the medical school and chair of the psychiatry department, and I've studied the insanity defense for the last 30-plus years. Okay. What we're trying to do here, and we appreciate your helping us with this bill, is to provide high-quality testimony and evaluation to the courts in Oregon. This is an important issue because if you look on the third paragraph in my testimony, there are about 70-plus people per year committed to the jurisdiction of the review board. You had a high of 126 in 2004 and 51 in 1989. The board has operated since 1978. It's had over 2,000 people under its jurisdiction, and it's been a national model and highly successful in its operation. But the point is, one of the main points is that it's highly labor intensive, it's highly expensive for the state. There are now about 700 people under the jurisdiction of the board. Half of them are at the Oregon State Hospital, half are on conditional release in the community, and it's very, very important to get it right at the front end, because the consequences of someone committed to the jurisdiction of the board who might not have been a good candidate for an insanity defense, the consequences are very high, both monetarily, in terms of the operation of the mental health system. There are many issues that you're dealing with, including building new hospitals, part of which are forensic hospitals. So there's a lot at stake in this particular area in getting it right at the front end. So what we tried to do was to propose a certification process that would provide training to psychiatrists and psychologists who are doing this type of work, so that they would understand some of the intricacies of the defense itself, they'd understand some of the recent changes from the Oregon Appeals Courts, and that they would provide high-quality work to the Oregon trial courts. That's the goal of this. It's not that unusual. It's done in other states, and the Oregon Mental Health Division has been providing certification or training for at least the last 30 years, since I did it for a number of years, on the civil commitment statute, which is another statute that gets people involuntarily into the hospital, but on the civil side. So they've provided training, I think it's twice a year, for many, many years. And that's what we want to try to accomplish with this bill. The intent in dropping out the evaluation after the defense is successful was to try to move everything back to the trial court level when it really is necessary to have these reports, to try to do what was in the material we're proposing leaving out, to try to do all of that at the time of the trial and get it all done at that point. And we had no intent of trying to change any indigent fund payment for people, but we thought that would be handled in the way it's been handled for many, many years by the prosecutors and defense attorneys and judges at the time of the trial or prior to trial. So that's the general goal of this, and we will try to work on it and try to smooth out any problems that might exist here. And we think it would be a major step forward. And again, thank you for considering this.
Thank you, Dr. Bloom. What is the system now? Is it that someone who, a defendant who wishes to assert an insanity defense, is sort of free to choose whatever source of expert verification or support they can reach to?
Yes, it's a very, very interesting thing. We have, if you consider the review board to be the back end of the process, after someone is found guilty except for insanity, we have one of the tightest systems in the country for managing people who are insanity acquittees. And on the other side, we have one of the loosest systems in the country, which exists in a number of states, which is a free-for-all. You can choose anybody you want. You can provide any testimony that will succeed in the cross-examination process, in the adversarial process. But, yes, it's very laissez-faire on the front end, very regulated once a person's committed to the review board. And we just want to tighten it up a little on the front end.
Any questions for Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I would like some clarification. Is your intent to have the public hearing now and to do some modification, amendment to
there,
language?
They have already indicated that there are amendments. So, and of course, we won't even have an opportunity to finish the public hearing today. We're getting Dr. Bloom on because he traveled at a distance.
Understood. I just would like to indicate that I have some constituents who have brought to me concerns in regard to, there is nexus to this bill, so in regard to even the plea of guilty by except for insanity, and would be interested in exploring not guilty by reason of insanity, which I understand is there is some historical precedent for that before that was actually, the language was actually changed. So I would like to have some conversations offline about that issue.
Okay, I'd be happy to go over that with you and to meet with you about that.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Then I'm going to just ask one, I think it would be. Is there, and this may be outside of your expertise, Dr. Bloom, but is there any constitutional issue with respect to limiting the right of a defendant to assert an insanity defense, that is saying you have to get one of these certified people to support your assertion of that defense? Or are we free to legislate in any way we choose as a matter of policy?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, that's an interesting question. I don't know that there would be a constitutional issue. And certainly in other states, these evaluations are limited. Some states have court clinics where people have to funnel through the court clinics. Other states have a system like this. But I'm sure that will be raised as an issue if this is successful or prior to your final deliberations.
Any further questions? Seeing none, then I'll excuse you, Dr. Bloom. Thank you for your patience in waiting through a long hearing to get to this item. We're going to have to close the hearing on House Bill 2858 now because of lack of time. That we will be carrying over then the continuation of public hearing on both 2858 and 3163 to our next meeting on Monday, the 26th of March. That concludes as much of our agenda as we can complete today. Thank you for your attendance, committee. We're adjourned.